This is HEC Media.
Welcome to Talking with Authors, a program dedicated to speaking with some of the best-selling authors around, covering many different genres. I'm your podcast host, Rod Milam, for HEC Media. With the help of independent bookstore Left Bank Books and the St. Louis County Library, we are able to sit down with some amazing writers and thought leaders to discuss their work, their inspiration, and what makes them special. By the way, you can also watch video versions of most of these episodes by going to hecmedia.org. Now, after the initial weeks of the coronavirus global shutdown, we were able to set up remote video interviews with many authors. The sound quality may be slightly different than our previous podcasts, but they still contain the same great content that you've come to expect. Today, our guest is journalist and sports writer Reed Forgrave. We spoke with him via Zoom in October of 2020 about his book, Love, Zach, by publisher Algonquin Books. Writer Reed Forgrave has spent most of his career covering sports. He's done long-form reporting on the Olympics, basketball, and the NFL, and worked with the New York Times, CBS Sports, and other organizations. But in his book, Love, Zach, he takes on the real-life tragic death of a small-town high school football player that was ultimately found to have died from the effects of CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Think of it as tearing and bruising of the brain tissue. The brain is delicate, it's protected by the skull and by fluid in there. When it's going really fast and then stops, it can be bruised. And when it tears, you can see the buildup of proteins. And think of it as sort of congestion on the brain highway. Things don't move as quickly as they normally would.
Zach Easter took his own life, but left behind enough clues to what he thought was wrong with him so that he would feel like his life had meaning. We'll find out the impact that Zach's death had on his family, his hometown, the sports community, and our guest as well, writer Reed Forgrave, on this edition of Talking with Authors from HEC Media and HEC Books. Here's our host and interviewer this time, Victoria Babu.
Well, Reed, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We appreciate the work that you've done and introducing us to your first book, your debut book called Love, Zach, Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy. Yes. Quite an eye opener. You think of Texas, at least I do. High school football is a religion. States like that, because it's, you know, everything's bigger in Texas. But it's really all over small towns all over America. And you really point that out in the book. Also, I've been thinking of my husband, who's from Southeast Missouri, a little town. All the money goes into their football stadium. The whole town comes out. They follow them when they're on the road. It is truly a mindset and a culture. And that's what you delve into with Love, Zach, because, you know, it's heart-wrenching. It's tragic that a 24-year-old boy takes his own life because of football injuries. It really, would you describe this book somewhat of as a warning, as an education? It really is kind of a memoir, autobiography, so many things wrapped into one because of what Zach left those who survived.
Yeah, I mean, in one way, this book is a cautionary tale. It's a, you know, it's a story about a guy who fully bought into that football culture and sort of that tough it out culture, which eventually became Zach Easter's demise. This was how Zach defined what it meant to be a man. He was the middle son of three sons. His family had lived on this land in outside of small town Iowa for seven generations since before the Civil War. And their definition of what it meant to be a man very much sprung from living off the land and hunting and being tough. And in modern day America, often the way that is expressed is through football. So is it a cautionary tale? Yes, absolutely. Especially for someone like myself, who's a parent of two young boys. I don't think this book says, don't play football, football should go away. Not in any means. It goes into both the risks of football and the rewards of football. This is a story about Zach, but really I think this is a story about America, right? Like what it means to be a man in 21st century America. It's about parenting. It's about what fathers pass on to their sons. I think one of the catchwords out there today is toxic masculinity. And I think this book is really about that blurry line between what we think of as traditional masculinity and where that morphs into toxic masculinity. And I think it can be really hard to say where that line is. Because if you look at Zach's father, he's a loving dad. He was a football player, Division I football player, grew up loving this sport, was a college coach, and then became high school coach for all three of his sons. And he really hammered football into their, into who they, their identity, I think. And there's good in that. There's good in teaching a boy to become a strong, tough man. But then it can also, it comes fraught with potential pitfalls when you're being not just tough, but stoic, when you're not just being strong, but you're ignoring some very, very concerning symptoms. And I think Zach is emblematic of all those things.
You know, that's a good point. And I'm going to turn to page 27 of the book because I marked this. And it sums up what you just said. Zach actually writes this. And for those who haven't seen a synopsis of the book, he leaves a memoir that is so vivid and heart-wrenching, but lucid at times, that you feel what he's going through in his mind and physically. But along the way in his writings, in his journals that he leaves for his family, he writes, quote, "I won't lie. I look back now and always felt like I had something to prove to my dad and trying to fill my older brother's football shoes." That kind of sums up what you just said, Reed.
Yeah, I mean, I think what makes Zach's story stand out amidst the many stories, the tragic stories that we've heard about football and concussions and in some cases CTE, the disease that Zach thought he had and turned out, you know, posthumously they studied his brain. And yes, he did have this disease that we associate with 20-year NFL players like Junior Seau. What sets Zach's story apart is that, like you said, he left behind these writings. He left behind these handwritten journals that document day by day his up and down moods. He left behind a 39-page typewritten autobiography that shows, he titled it Concussions, My Silent Struggle. And it documents how going back to third grade when he started playing tackle football up through high school, when he stopped, concussions happened again and again and again. And he really suffered through them. And then also, his girlfriend, Allie, who I think is one of the heroes of this book, gave me just a boatload of text messages. So what's different about this book is Zach is speaking directly to you from beyond the grave, and it can be very haunting. And that line that you brought up, Zach is smaller than his father. He's smaller than his older brother. His older brother is in the Indianola High School Athletics Hall of Fame. His father was this well-known football coach in town, so well-known that they speak about the Easter mentality, which is basically rub dirt in it and take a lap. Be tougher than the other kid. Zach was smaller than his older brother and smaller than his dad, but a lot of times they would talk about Zach had the strongest mentality out there. He was the toughest son of a gun out of all of them. So even though his body didn't measure up to what we see as football stars, his mind, in a way, was exactly what every football coach wants. They want someone who's fearless. They want someone who will put their body on the line. Unfortunately, Zach took it too far. A coach wants you to go completely all out. These days, in 2020 in American football, completely go all out without abandon until that point where you're about to bang heads. It's really hard, I think, for modern day football players to be able to walk that line where it's like, I'm a warrior going to war, and yet if I do this, that's the worst thing I can do. I'll get a 15-yard penalty, I'll get kicked out of the game, and my brain might be permanently messed up after a series of these. It's a difficult position, I think, that athletes and parents are in right now when we look at football, because now, unlike Zach, we know now. We know now what can happen from this.
That's important because when you look at the timeline for Zach, started at third grade in 2015. So third grade, he starts football, plays it all through high school, stops after high school. But that's when really all the trauma was happening a senior year, but it really rears its ugly head during college until he passes in 2015 at age 24. So let's go back a little bit, Reed, and because you delve not only into the history of football, which is important for someone like me, coming from mostly girls in my family, not that we didn't like football, it just wasn't that mentality that my husband grew up in, only an only child and a football player in high school. So, you know, it put in perspective for me, which is great for all readers out there. So when we look at going back, he didn't really know about CTE. It really wasn't even in the media. It was just coming out maybe his senior year. I think you wrote in the book about some of the findings others were writing about, other of your colleagues in journalism and sports journalism. So describe to us CTE, which stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. I practiced that.
Not an easy one to practice. It's a big word.
Which means what? What does that mean? What is going on in the brain?
Think of it as tearing and bruising of the brain tissue. When you get these hits, the brain is delicate. It's protected by the skull and by fluid in there. And it's not just when it gets actually hit, but when it gets jostled, when it's going really fast and then stops, it can be bruised. And it will tear up. And when it tears, and I'll do this the best I can in a layman's way without being a scientist myself, but basically like enzymes are released, proteins are released, and there will be a protein buildup. And that's when doctors like Dr. Bennett Amalu, who actually was the one who sent the email to Brenda Easter saying, we got results from the brain study of Zach, and yes, he does have stage 2 CTE for a 24-year-old, which is just really scary, I think. And he's also the doctor who basically discovered this disease, played by Will Smith in that movie Concussion. But you can see the buildup of proteins in the brain. And think of it as sort of congestion on the brain highway, in a way, that things don't move as quickly as they normally would. It's a scary disease, right? It's really scary because it's one thing to have a broken arm. You can have an x-ray to tell you have a broken arm and you'll be better in 2 months. It's another thing. You don't have an x-ray that can say you have a broken brain. It can't be diagnosed until after death, which is, you know, the science on this is just so, so young. And I'm glad you bring up the timing of this because Zach graduated in 2010 during his senior year of high school was when Jean-Marie Laskus wrote an article for GQ magazine about Bennett Amalu and sort of the fight of these researchers against the NFL. That became the movie Concussion. And that was at the same time that Alan Swartz with the New York Times was writing the first articles equating these tragic suicides from NFL players with this crazy brain disease. So Zach's parents have culpable deniability in a way because they didn't know. I mean, he always knew football was dangerous. You didn't know it could, you know, permanently alter the brain.
When he had these concussions, let me go back a little bit. There were so many coaches along the way, including his own father. I don't know if they were in denial. I didn't get that from your book. It's just like we didn't know. This is they knew what they knew. You know, put me back in, coach, that whole mentality that Zach had and so many other young men playing football really made it hard for trainer Sue Wilson. I had to empathize with her when I read about her because it was really her against everyone else for many, many cases. Parents were against her because she's the one that's saying, I'm taking your helmet and you're sitting out the game. She would look in the eyes of the players and specifically Zach. And, you know, he was good at lying as much as he could to get away with to get into the game.
And so many players are because that's a tenet of football, right? Be tough, tough it out. You get a bum ankle, whatever. It's Friday night. Get out there and be the star. That is, I mean, I do think there's some good in that mentality, like the life lessons, fighting through adversity. But boy, when it comes to the brain, that's incredibly dangerous. Sue Wilson started at Indianola High School as a trainer in the mid-2000s, just as Zach is entering this high school program. And I think, first of all, the fact that she is a woman entering this, like, super macho world made it incredibly difficult for her. And also because she was ahead of the concussion curve. She was paying attention to this more than just about anyone. And she'd be on the sideline on Friday nights And what she would say, if a player suffered a hit that seemed to be a concussion, and remember, even now, even in 2020, we don't have like a sideline test that you can say, for sure, this is a concussion, you're out of the game. It's, hey, I'm going to look at your eyes. Are your eyes jiggling? Are you foggy? Are you focused? And I'm going to guess that you have a concussion. We're not going to risk it. She'd take their helmet and she'd be like, I'm taking your helmet. You're not going back in. Coaches would be mad at her. Fans would be mad at her. Parents of players who were taken out of the game would be mad at her for taking their son out of the game. There was one time in this book where a star wide receiver was taken out of the game. He was mad about it. He cussed out Sue Wilson. And in the stands was a doctor from town. And he went to, it was either the principal or the superintendent after the game. And he questioned Sue Wilson's credentials. Why is this lady allowed to take this star player out of the game? When we look back in that, in retrospect, it's insane, especially when we think about everything that has happened with the sport of football. And I think one of the many, you know, dark ironies of this book is that wide receiver, that star wide receiver pulled out of that game, he's now an emergency room doctor. In a way, Sue Wilson, who knows what could have happened, but she might have saved his brain so that he could go on to big success outside the sport of football.
I want to talk about the parents, because you do a very good job of describing their relationship, because that's very vital, as you mentioned earlier, that mindset, that culture, but mainly the mindset within the family. Football was a religion to them. It was their life, including Brenda, who married the dad, Miles, and had the three boys, and it was just ingrained in them. And they all accepted the bumps and the bruises. But let's talk about guilt. Did they ever feel that? He talks about it somewhat in your book.
Yeah, absolutely. Brenda is so if I could like just give like a brief overview of their personalities. Brenda is a fixer. She is the president of the small town chamber of commerce. She knows everybody in town. If you bring Brenda a problem, she's a lot like my own mom, where she's like, okay, you have a problem? Okay, right now I'm going to try to come up with solutions. When she finds out Zach's suffering, she says, okay, let's fix it. Those are her exact words. She's going to his doctor's appointments with him against his will, almost. She's trying to find clinics that deal with both addiction issues and traumatic brain injury issues. I think Zach did have some drug and alcohol addiction issues. I'm not sure where the chicken and the egg comes in, but I'm not sure if it really matters. His father's different. His father, I think, in a way, feels much more guilt from this. I think he is tortured and on a daily basis devastated by this, but he's not someone who's going to go share that. I mean, I quoted him. I'm not going to give you the full quote because I believe this is a little bit profane and there are some profanities in this book, but he said, I'm not going to therapy. I don't need no therapy. He's not a guy who's going to talk it out. He grabs a couple of beers. He goes out with his two dogs and goes into the woods behind their house with a shotgun and goes hunting. That's his therapy. And I think he feels an enormous amount of guilt because he ultimately was the one that pushed his sons into football. He says in the book, it came to the point where it's almost like I loved football even more than my sons did. He was obsessed with it. And yet I think there are two things that kind of keep him going on. One is, he didn't know. If he knew, if this was going on right now in 2020, if Zach was a sixth grader in 2020, and then he pushed him that far, going through concussion after concussion after concussion, I'm not sure if Miles Easter could go on. And the other part that I think brings the rest of his family, you'll never get past this, right? You never should, but lets them move forward, is the fact that Zach left all these writings that it sometimes blamed football and certain points actually blamed sort of his spot in the family. Talk about that older brother and father quote that he always had to live up to him. But most of them say, please don't blame yourselves. Please don't blame football. Make a meaning out of my life. And I think this family, that is in a weird way, the silver lining to this really, really dark cloud that Zach gave them a charge, said, make a meaning out of this awful, awful tragedy that is my life and death.
And in fairness to the family and friends and Allie, well, whom he was more open with was Allie, his girlfriend, which you mentioned the text messages were so helpful in getting into the psyche of and the deterioration of Zach, but that he hid a lot of his pain.
Yeah.
He was must have been pretty darn good at it.
I think a lot of people are. And this is not, like I said earlier, this is not a disease that you can take an X-ray of. A lot of it depends on how good is someone at faking it. Back then, I think the mentality was, of course I'm going to fake it because I want to play next Friday night. I mean, people would refer to this as getting their bell rung. I went to a brain conference at the University of North Carolina as part of this book. And one of these brain doctors who's been doing research into this for 30 years mentioned when he played high school football and all his teammates would get together 5, 10, 15 years after, they'd laugh about, hey, remember that one time when you got your bell rung and you were wobbling off the field? It used to be funny. We used to have these videos that the NFL would produce that would be like bone-crunching hits on ESPN. It would have these segments that would say, he got jacked up. It was – we made light of it. And
the helmets? The helmets coming together.
Monday Night Football, right? Exactly. Like that hit that was for, what, 20 years was like the opening graphic to Monday Night Football. Like even that is disturbing in retrospect. So this isn't – so much about Zach's dad and Zach's reaction to being part of this family as it is this entire culture of football, which, you know, I know we're being critical of it right now, and there are a lot of toxic things about football culture, but there's some good things about it too, that teach you to be tough, teach you to be a team, that, you know, the idea of, like, you know, we call baseball America's pastime. Football ain't a pastime. It's our sporting religion, right? Like if you have a baseball game in a small town, you know, the 20 players on the team go on a bus and they play and they come back. And, you know, no one really knows the difference. If you have a football game on a Friday night, the entire town, you know, gets on a bus, gets in their cars and moves over to this other small town. And it's like, I mean, there's some camaraderie that is part of football that's unlike any other sport.
Coming up, our guest Reed Forgrave will talk about how the people in the hometown of Zach Easter influenced his decision to write Love, Zach.
His friend sent me his obituary, and it was heartbreaking, as any obituary of a 24-year-old would be. But then the final paragraph of this obituary said, in just the most forthright terms, basically Zach wants his life to have meaning. He suffered through this awful disease, CTE, for years. So I got on the phone. I ended up connecting with Brenda Easter, and she said, come on down. And 2 weeks after his death, I'm sitting on their living room floor for 4 hours with the Packers-Vikings game on the TV behind us while we're talking about how football killed their son.
We'll hear what Zach's family in the end thought about the book and how this sports writer feels about collision sports after penning his story when Talking with Authors continues from HEC Media.
Educate Today offers an ever-growing library of the highest quality video resources, curriculum materials, and interactive programs, all of which are designed to challenge thinking, inspire creativity, and empower learning of students, educators, parents, and lifelong learners. And you can find out more about all these programs by going online to educate.today. That's educate.today.
There are a lot of folks out there who have sons that are playing. There might be third grade on up to high school as they hope to get into college. You mentioned Dr. Omalu had mentioned at one time that maybe kids shouldn't play high school as young as third grade or even middle school or even high school. But the problem is then you can't recruit for college or for the NFL. That would be an issue, I suppose, right?
What Dr. Omalu says is his solution for this, he says, shouldn't be able to play football until you turn 18. I mean, full contact, helmets and pads football, what we think of as actual football. And the reason he says that is because that's the point where the brain is close to fully developed. And it's because he looks at age 18, he's like, that's the age of legal consent. Some people like to smoke cigarettes. They know it's damaging to their body. Turn 18 and you can do that legally. It's sort of the same analogy with football. I think it's You know, Benedict Mala didn't grow up in America. He didn't grow up in this culture. I grew up in Pittsburgh. I grew up in a place that has such a football culture. You know, in fact, that was where Benedict Mala was working when he studied Mike Webster's brain. Was essentially patient zero in this CTE, I don't know if I want to call it an epidemic, but crisis, I think, would be a proper word for this. When you grow up in that culture and you look at the idea of don't play football until 18, well, you're like, okay, then in a generation or two, football goes away. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a bad thing. I tend to think it's a bad thing. I'm still, despite writing this book, I'm still a football fan, which either makes me honest or a hypocrite. I'm not sure which one.
You do write at the end of the book that you still love football. You'll sit down and watch it, but you and your wife have an agreement. You're not going to allow your two young sons to play. Are you still holding true to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's our sons are 8 and 4 right now. And right now, my wife and I talk about this in the theoretical, right? Where it's like, hey, if someday they want to play football, we'll be like, hey, have you thought about basketball? My wife's dad is 6'4", so basketball might be the right sport for them. But it's theoretical now. I do think it's a different conversation when one of my kids is 14 years old and all his friends are playing football and he's been tossing around the background in the backyard for years. And, you know, I've been watching the Vikings lose every Sunday with him in the fall for a decade. And he's going to come to me and be like, Dad, all my friends are doing this. Why can't I do this? I'll be careful. I promise. It's a different conversation. My gut still says no. I'm not even sure if I have a voice in it because my wife feels very strongly about it. And so does my mother. But it is a different thing when it becomes very real. I do sometimes frequently feel like a hypocrite because I am still a football fan. I'm actually curious, as someone who read this book, do you think I'm a hypocrite after writing about this family and being very eyes wide open about football to still go out there and watch? Because I feel like that sometimes.
No, I get it. I do feel that you're being honest because you say, I'm just going to still watch it. But, you know, maybe along the way too, I mean, you're protecting your sons. That's a natural feeling right now. But you're smart to think ahead because that peer pressure can be great. And the only thing I can say, because I don't have sons, is tell me more about the helmets. How protected is my son going to be if I have one? Those kind of things. Are the coaches and trainers more aware now that they will take a child out of the game? Do you see that there's more protections that you can kind of validate it?
I think, and there have been, I write about some of these in the book, there have been, over the past decade and a half, a lot, it's not perfect, but from the NFL down to like Pop Warner and Pee Wee football, there have been improvements across the board. NFL's made 40-some rule changes in the past decade. You see players ejected, especially in college. I think college is actually taking it more seriously than the NFL, but like, targeting penalties, head-on-head contact, boom, you're out of the game. Like, no questions asked immediately. In the NFL, they're taking it not quite to that extent. And there are times that you will see players with big hits. You're like, why did that guy not get ejected immediately? Why is this even a question? But, you know, it's a $1 billion industry, right? $15 billion a year in revenue. So it makes sense in a way that they treat it a little bit more easily, I guess. The helmet question, I think, is a really interesting one because helmet technology has improved. But the NFL has grading system for helmets. It's like red, yellow, green. Red is like the worst style, and they're slowly phasing those out. New helmets that come in are the green style, which is like they're like the highest rated helmets as far as safety goes. I don't think helmets are going to save this problem. I don't think they're going to solve this problem.
Not if you're going head to head like that. I mean,
I mean, you can legislate unnecessary roughness out of the game mostly through all these rule changes, but I don't think you can legislate necessary roughness, which is like, you know, these are like the sub-concussive hits that happen every single play, especially between linemen who smack their heads against each other 50 or 60 times a game. That's football. That's baked into this sport. Science doesn't fully know whether it's those massive hits, those actual concussive hits that are the dominant precursor to CTE, or whether it's these lesser hits, these subconcussive hits that build up over time. That, to me, is what scares me much, much more.
Right, right, because it's a buildup, and it seems like that could have happened to Zach, but they'll never know. They just know that over the years, time just eroded him.
It's less detectable. One of the things that Brenda Easter, Zach's mom, is so excited about, they started a foundation in Zach's honor, and they're trying to, they're funding they refer to it as a saliva study, which is basically like you get a big hit, you on the sidelines, you spit in a cup, and that can be tested. The proteins and enzymes in the spit can be tested to say positively, yes or no. Yes, you got a concussion. No, you didn't get a concussion. So it takes out the lying and the guesswork of doctors. That's an important step, but it doesn't solve the subconcussive stuff. And that's where I think subconcussive hits are, that is the existential question for the NFL. And I think for football as a sport.
Well, when you say football here, but in Europe, they'll say football for soccer. Soccer equally dangerous, because I do know it's big here in St. Louis, and I do know a former professional player who said for 8 years he didn't have any dreams, because he had so many concussions from the headbutts of soccer. And so that's another sport with no helmets that also has an issue.
Especially in youth soccer, they are trying to take headers out of the game. Soccer is taking it seriously. Ice hockey is taking it seriously. We've seen some of those tragic stories come out of the NHL, guys like Derek Bugard, who were – you know, the tough guys, the fighters on teams. You've seen them have tragic stories like the Junior Seau's of the NFL. This isn't just by no means an American football question. It's a contact sports question. But I do think it's harder to fully take the head out of football compared to any other sport. You can improve on the margins. Like the Seattle Seahawks coach, Pete Carroll, has popularized something called Hawk-style tackling, which is basically take the head out of the tackles, more rugby-style tackling, and it helps. But it's baked into the game. It's not just a bug of the game. It's a feature of it. We enjoy the violence of football.
Right. The modern-day gladiator or the warrior. Reed, I want to go back to how you found this story, because 2 weeks after Zach took his own life, you met with the family in person. So how did this come to your attention?
You know, I was actually back in Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania visiting my family for the holidays, and an old friend sent me an obituary from the Des Moines Register in Des Moines, Iowa, newspaper I worked at for 6 years. I was then working for Fox Sports as a national writer, mostly focused on basketball. And this friend sent me his obituary, and it was heartbreaking, as any obituary of a 24-year-old would be. But then the final paragraph of this obituary said, in just the most forthright terms, basically, Zach wants his life to have meaning. He suffered through this awful disease, CTE, for years. It talks about how he was having brain tremors and migraines and memory struggles and slurred speech and dementia. And you're like, holy crap. One, these symptoms are awful. And two, this family put it out there in such a such a forthright way. So I got on the phone and I had some contacts in this small town. I ended up connecting with Brenda Easter. It might have been just a day before Christmas. I think it was the day after his funeral. And she said, come on down. And she was motivated. The family was motivated because Zach left behind these instructions. And yeah, 2 weeks after his death, I'm sitting on their living room floor for 4 hours. By the way, with the Packers-Vikings game on the TV behind us while we're talking about how football killed their son.
Right. I mean, that hasn't left their family. I give them credit. I think they're very brave, because as much as it was, once you read the book, you'll understand how ingrained this is in their being, head to toe, the whole family, the culture within the town, that it was very brave of them to come forward. But what a gift in a way, but sacrifice Zach made. It felt like a sacrifice. I think he even said that, didn't he?
Yeah, I like that you use that word sacrifice, because I think a lot of people think of suicide as the ultimate selfish act. Like, I'm going to give up. And in the prologue to this book, it's talking about Zach's first suicide attempt, which was about 5 weeks before his final suicide attempt. And he says, "I'm sorry, I'm taking the selfish way out. I don't want to glorify suicide and by any way, but at some point Zach lost hope. And at the same time, he wanted to one, have a legacy, to sort of make his life live beyond his death, and two, to save other people from what he'd gone through. I mean, not to be too graphic, but that's why he shot himself in the chest, because he wanted to preserve his brain for science. That's why I think he left behind all these journals and these explicit instructions to his family to say, tell my story. And that's why this family is, I mean, courageous, heroic in not just sharing, hey, this was our beloved son and we loved Zach for all these reasons. Every family wants to do that after a death. But not every family wants to say, here are the darkest moments of Zach's life. Here are some incredibly embarrassing moments that he lived through. This family shared that because they recognized that's the point. That's framing his life as a sacrifice. You have to have all that darkness in there to really illuminate the reasons that he did die at age 24.
It's very descriptive, his feelings and what he was going through. But what a help he gave doctors and researchers too, because they really did, he really did go into his psyche and his feelings. And then for the family, there's something constructive about starting the foundation, CTE Hope. I understand some of the proceeds of this book is going to that foundation.
Absolutely, yes. And they started this shortly after his death. I've been to, I think, a couple of they have annual galas. They've been raising money, via selling some of these books. It's a way to move forward, not to get over something, but it's a way to make a meaning out of this sort of meaningless tragedy.
What's frustrating for survivors of someone who's taken their own life is the not knowing. Zach was so lucid at times to write really very articulately and very raw about how he was feeling. And I mean, pretty raw at some points. So how do you explain Zach's moments when he was lucid enough to be so descriptive about what he wanted done, how he felt, versus someone else who takes their own life and leaves nothing?
Yeah, I mean, he had some sort of foresight that he should write this down. He's not lucid throughout these journals. You can see it. He pings back and forth between being hopeful and being like, I'm going to go get this job. I'm going to apply for 6 jobs today. I'm going to quit chewing tobacco in the next month. I'm going to be a millionaire in 5 years. You see him have these big ambitions. And then 2 days later, you see him say, I went to the therapist today, but I just sat in my car in the parking lot. I couldn't go in. I got a bunch of cocaine and I did it. And, F this. I don't want to live anymore. That's very CTE of him. He's pinging back and forth with these emotions. But I remember the very first time his family, after meeting them that first time, I went back to Iowa and they gave me this tub full of journals and with his laptop, all this stuff. And they're like, here, go look at it. And I went to a conference room at a local college for hours that day, looking through his journals. And a lot of them were just kind of like, one of them was a motivational journal where he was reading a Tony Robbins book. I was like, I'm going to write my 18 steps to become a better man. It wasn't particularly useful for what I was looking for. One of them was more like a medical journal, which was helpful, but it was more clinical. And I specifically remember opening up this Black Mead 5-star journal, turning that opening cover and seeing him in his chicken scratch handwriting, writing, it was like June 2nd, 2015. And it basically said, hello, Mr. Journal. I've never done this before, but I'm going to give it a try. He thought that it was, and I think this was part of his trying to help his memory to write things down. But right when I was reading that journal, it was like, oh my God, he's documenting, sometimes lucid, sometimes not. But he's documenting these ups and downs that he's experiencing. He's, in his less lucid moments, he's doing things like going to the hardware store and forgetting why he went there, just wandering around the hardware store, not knowing why he's there. Things like driving back home from Des Moines to his childhood home and getting lost. But he has the foresight to put pen to paper and record these moments. I like to think that Zach, in a way, knew that there was some sort of value somehow, for himself and his own memory issues, but also just for writing this down in a way for history. And it was, I mean, without Zach's writings, this isn't a book. It's a tragedy. But Zach doesn't speak to you from beyond the grave. That's the power of this book.
Can I ask what the family thinks of the book?
I was terrified. I didn't want them to have pre-publication review. I didn't want them to feel, 6 months before the book came out, I don't like chapter four, can you change it? And having to have that awkward conversation. So I didn't want them to have the book until it was basically set in stone. They find the book incredibly painful and incredibly worthy. They find it to be an accurate portrayal of his, very inspiring life. Like he was the type of guy, boy next door, a guy who loves everybody. And also an accurate portrayal of his tragic death. His mother told me, it was like a week before the book officially came out, she told me she was dreading when it was going to come out. She told me that she was having nightmares about it. And then after we did the launch event, she sent me just the kindest text message about this, saying, you're the one to spread his story. Thank you so much. And which meant, I don't care if I get like a review in New York Times, right? Like that text message was more meaningful than anything. His girlfriend, she had one correction in the book. And it was like a date was wrong. It was a Saturday instead of a Friday. It was, she read it twice in 2 days and she said it was really a bizarre experience. She didn't want her parents to read the sex scene that's in the book. But I think that she recognizes there's power in sort of airing this family's dirty laundry and showing all their pain.
Right. Yeah, it is very revealing. But again, that was my first thought as a parent, was like, wow, that's amazing that this reporter, Reed Forgrave, could sit down with this family. And they were very, very forthcoming and honest. And that's what makes it so great, because really Zach was. So in a way, in a weird way, now that I think about it, what love they had for each other.
Yeah. I mean, this family, because Zach left these explicit instructions, family was so motivated to tell the true and awful story here. Without that sort of motivation, I mean, there's so much stigma and shame that come with mental illness and / suicide. It would have been really hard to gain their trust.
And Zach never blamed anybody. Right. I don't remember him blaming anyone.
There were a couple parts where he blames football and he blames sort of the culture that he was raised in. Much more often than that, he says, please don't blame yourselves. This was inevitable. I'm in God's hands now. He takes pains to make sure that his parents don't blame themselves, which is, good on him, because just leaving something behind, like suicide, like you said earlier, it's such a mystery. And I think that can be some of the most difficult parts for families, to being like, why? Why did he do this? Well, they have a boatload of explanations for why he did this.
Well, hopefully helping other families, and especially through their CTE Hope, their foundation, that they can help with research. So Reed Forgrave, thank you so much. And again, proceeds from the book do go to their foundation, CTE Hope. We appreciate your time and the work that you've done.
This is great. Thanks, Victoria.
That was our guest, journalist and sports writer Reed Forgrave. We spoke with him via Zoom in October of 2020 about his book, Love, Zach, by publisher Algonquin Books. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Talking with Authors. Remember, you can watch most of the episodes of this program by going online to hecmedia.org. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. Just search for Talking with Authors on all social media platforms. And if you haven't done so yet, please rate and review this program wherever you get your podcasts. The interviewer and video producer for this episode of the program was Victoria Babu. Our video editor was Carrie Marks. Supervising producer was Julie Winkle. Production support by Jane Ballou and Christina Chastain. HEC Media Executive Director is Dennis Riggs. The Talking with Authors podcast executive producer is Christina Chastain. Podcast audio editing by Paul Langdon. And I'm Rod Milam, your podcast producer and host. Special thanks to the St. Louis County Library and Left Bank Books. Again, thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This is HEC Media.
You wake up, you get dressed, you prepare for a day of challenging and inspiring young minds, but maybe all you get is frustration and anxiety. You are a teacher. In the Classroom Matters podcast, we discuss the good, the bad, and the ugly of education. We talk to people such as Kim Bearden, co-founder of the Ron Clark Academy, Ken Williams, creator of Unfold the Soul, Teacher of the Year Beth Davey, and so many more insightful educators. Because your voice matters, your experience matters, your classroom matters. Classroom Matters with Christy Houle, a new podcast from Educate.today. Subscribe and download now.